Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Yes, the rumors are true, my friends. This Sunday, I'm going to be co-hosting with Matt Dillahunty on the Atheist Experience TV show. They are celebrating their 1,000th episode, so Matt calls up and he's like, "Hey, man, would you like to come down and be a part of the show as we mark the occasion?" Sure. I mean, I would love to do that. I've had sort of an open invitation to participate on the Atheist Experience for the past several years, but it just hasn't worked out. I haven't been in Austin at the right time or the dates or this or that. But I'm going to drive down just for this coming up on Sunday. It's going to, of course, go out live as it always does, and it's an archive forever. So if you're not around the live stream on Sunday, don't worry. It'll be out there pretty much forever. It'll be myself, Matt Dillahunty. I'm excited, kind of nervous about it, because I do live shows, but like live television is not really my sandbox. But, you know, I just love Matt to death. He's a brother, and I think we're going to be great, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'll be sort of interested to see what happens. And I guess there's a live audience, and after the show, we all get to go out to eat somewhere. So it's going to be a whole day of heathenry and shenanigans. The website for the Atheist Experience, if you want to see everything, it's atheist-experience.com. And congratulations to those guys for 1,000 shows, 1,000 broadcasts. Hell, I'm not even at 400. And you know, I feel like, let's see, how many years have I been doing this? 8 years, almost 8 exactly. And just cranking out a show a week. And the fact that they are at 1,000 is just, that's a massive accomplishment. Huge congrats out to them. In the coming weeks on this show, we're going to talk about some heavy topics. I haven't locked down the dates for them yet, but we're going to do a show about cults and the influences of cults, escaping cults. I actually might split this into a couple of shows because there's one conversation I'm going to have with a gentleman who escaped a very specific cult and has a very specific sort of a long form story. He's going to talk to me using a pseudonym. But I have a feeling that he and I will actually have a long enough conversation to be a whole freestanding thing. So we're going to do that. And of course, your perspectives, if you have experience with cults, let me know. If you want to talk about it, let me know. The email is podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. With the suicide, the recent suicide of Anthony Bourdain, which was just a shock to everyone. People are talking about the subject of suicide, taking one's life. Does it tie in this case to depression, mental illness, other factors? And how does the church often deal with suicide? Of course, there was that. So was it Bill Donahue at the Catholic Church who was saying that if he hadn't been an atheist, he wouldn't have taken his own life? Oh, we're going to do a broadcast about suicide in the church. We're going to take a very respectful yet very candid and direct look at the subject of suicide and dealing with it in the real world, and also having to deal with the claims coming out of religious institutions and people who are saying that suicide is this, or it's a spiritual war, or an attack, or a personal weakness, or part of a fallen world, or whoever commits suicide is automatically going to hell, all those horrible types of things. It's going to be a heavy show, but I think a necessary and compelling conversation. It's something we need to talk about. And so let's talk about that together. podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Today's show is a little bit lighter. It's a conversation you can watch in video form, the video link in the description box, so you can see it on YouTube, between myself and Scott Clifton. Scott is a television actor on a daytime drama, a soap opera. The Bold and the Beautiful. We'll get into that in just a second. So we had this conversation. The first half of the conversation, the first, I say, 30% is really us talking about show business. Just questions I've just asked, like, what's it like being on a soap? And then we really start to get into talking about him as an activist, because he is. He's an atheist activist on YouTube and beyond. And he has a lot of good stuff to say. It's a really fun and compelling conversation. So that's the content of today's broadcast. It is brought to you by our sponsor, Simple Contacts. And I love these guys. If you had told me even a few years ago that I could get my contact lens prescription renewed without a trip to the eye doctor, with a quick exam that I do on my cell phone or computer for $20, I mean, I cannot imagine I would have believed you. But it's real. I mean, it's real, and it's awesome. Simple Contacts brings the eye exam to you at a cost that is far below the self-pay prices out there that sometimes hit, what, $150, $200? Licensed ophthalmologists will review every exam very carefully, and then when you are renewed, Simple Contacts has great prices on all the brands of contact lenses that you know. And if you've got a current prescription that's already ready, you can just upload that info directly to Simple Contacts and you're all set. You can just place the order right then and there. It is so easy. I wear contacts for driving, for tennis. I took the $20 eye exam in my home office on my cell phone. I didn't blow half a day in the doctor's office. The contacts were in my mailbox in just a few days. Simple Contacts really is vision care for the 21st century and also a great way to support this broadcast. Find out why Simple Contacts has over 3,000 five-star reviews on their app store and get $30 off your contacts right now if you go to simplecontacts.com/SethAndrews and then use the promo code SethAndrews. Now, this is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but if your vision hasn't changed, Simple Contacts is the way to go. So check out Simple Contacts and get $30 off at simplecontacts.com/SethAndrews. Promo code SethAndrews. The year was about 2007, 2008. I was emerging from my faith. I was trying to figure out, you know, what an atheist is and discovering that I are one. And I was on YouTube sort of browsing around, keywording atheist, and I stumbled upon the work of Scott Clifton. I had no idea that he and I would rendezvous here on, on YouTube, social media, but on the internet. He's broadcasting, sort of Skyping in from L.A. Scott Clifton, good to have you, my friend.
Hey, good to be here, Seth. Thanks, man.
Your channel is called Theoretical Bullshit. Is it still going on today? You still use it?
Yeah, it's still there. I don't post as much. It's been about 2 years. But the channel's still up. All my old videos are still there. I don't delete them just so that people can see the sort of the changes that have taken place. And there have been changes. It's still around.
A lot of people know you from the YouTube channel, but a lot of people also know you from your, you know, your side gig. The other job that you have. So let's talk. I mean, what are you known for besides your YouTube activism?
I'm a contract actor on a soap opera, a daytime drama. So I guess I'm a soap star. Oh God, that sounds.
You got to say Emmy winning. You have to say I'm an Emmy winning daytime television actor. I think that's.
I'm a three-time Emmy winning daytime Emmy winning television actor. That doesn't count. Daytime Emmys don't count.
Picture you, you're on the bus coming in from Kansas with everything you own in the suitcase. You're going to make big.
One of those sticks with a hanky tied behind
it, like in the cartoons. But that's not the case, right? You're a native, is that right?
Yeah, no, I always joke that I'm one of the only actors in LA from LA. I was born and raised here. I wanted to be an actor. I think I figured that out around 8 or 9 years old, and my parents, bless their hearts, schlepped me all over town to auditions. And and then I got my first, I mean, I did little things here and there, but I really was an unsuccessful auditioner for like over a decade, I think. And then my first big real job was General Hospital, which is another soap opera. And I did that for about 5 years, and then I went to New York and I did a soap opera there for like a year and a half, and then I came back to LA and almost immediately booked this job that I'm doing now, which is The Bold and the Beautiful. And I've been doing that ever since. I've been on The Bold and Beautiful for 7 years, 8 years, something like that.
Who's your character on The Bold and the Beautiful?
Liam Spencer. Liam Spencer.
I mean, yeah, look, if I needed a primer, like on the character, I've been told that soap operas are largely this, like you can tune in at any one time and you largely are going to kind of, you can pick it up pretty quick.
Yeah, their soap operas are very much, they have the same business ethic as the tobacco industry. The whole it's to hook you. So there's a very specific formula. It's very repetitive, a lot of exposition. We repeat ourselves a lot. And then, you know, 50% of each episode is new information. But yeah, I mean, people who get stuck in the hospital, people whose grandparents force them to watch. I mean, these are our audience. I mean, people who just unwittingly ended up getting hooked.
We are going to talk about activism and science and philosophy and atheism, but I'm fascinated. Like, are you cramming every night? Is it like cramming for a test? Because I mean, it's a total marathon. You guys go in, you got a couple of takes, and you got fresh lines every day, and you're working a 6-day week. Is that accurate?
Yeah, yeah. We're lucky. We work, most soap operas work 5 days a week. They shoot an episode a day. An episode is an hour long. Our show is the only half an hour soap opera, so we shoot two episodes a day. But I memorize about 30 to 40 pages of dialogue every night. And then I go to work, and it's not, you know, I consider us technicians more than artists. I mean, there's a very specific product with a very specific formula, and we are pumping out a new episode every day. There's no time for a second or third take. You got to get it right. You have to know your lines. You have to know your marks. It's very, very high pressure, fast paced. So if I like went onto a movie set where, just as a basis of comparison, we shoot about 100 pages a day. They shoot 3 to 6 pages a day on
they'll spend the whole day lighting the scene, you know, right, kind of getting ready for you.
Yeah. So. And we're such a well-oiled machine that the lighting department and the directors and music, I mean, everybody's so well coordinated that it just goes so fast. So you kind of have to be, I'd be really bored on a movie set. I've had that fear. Like, oh my God, what if I get like a great movie part and I'm just like, I want to kill myself because I'm waiting around all day.
What if I become as successful as George Clooney? Shit. I know, what suck.
Oh, woe is me.
Scott, how many people have you kissed on screen? I mean, do you think I'm surrounded by beautiful people all day, every day, and I am up close and personal? It's an odd job that many would really like to have. I don't know. Do you want to talk about that, Scott?
I don't give a shit. Sure. Yeah, it is. I mean, that's part of the job. My character has been married probably over 10 times just on this particular show. I've had sex scenes with 7 or 8 different actresses.
I hear those are the least hot things to do. Like,
it's awful. It's so unsexy. Everything about it is technical. Move your shoulder blade an inch to the right and this and that. And the kissing it's not real kissing. You're simulating tongue, but there is no tongue, and there's a specific way to do it. I'm very lucky to have a wife who is one of the most rational people I've ever met, who is not in the industry and has no desire to be in the industry, and she still kind of appreciates what I do because I can feed us all. It's a lot of, but my wife kind of knows all my like female co-stars, and they hang out and we all get drinks together, and it's not what you probably imagine it to be. It's a very clinical kind of thing.
I saw some making of, it was a film that had Patrick Wilson in it. I can't remember the film or the scene, but it was behind the scenes of a love scene, and it was like the most technical, unhot, if that's a word, kind of thing. You know, it's just, they would pause them and then they would move them a little bit and then they'd say something and someone else would move a light and then they'd move a camera angle and they're holding in like absolutely still. And it's, you know, it sort of took me out of the moment, you know, it's just one of those things. Anyway. So I don't know. It's just one of those soap opera questions I thought I might ask just because we like to do the titillating stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I have an anecdote about that. That's kind of funny. Feel free to cut this out.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was talking about this with one of our directors. She's a director. She's an awesome director. She's been doing soaps for over 30 years. And we were talking about how a lot of A-list movie stars, you know, when they talk about, oh, my God, I had this sex scene and I had to drink, you know, 3 shots of tequila before the sex scene. And she and I, we were talking about this and kind of rolling our eyes going like, oh, grow, just be a professional and do the goddamn scene. Like, why is it so hard? And I was saying, well, maybe it is harder for them. Maybe the sex scenes are different, or maybe they involve more. Maybe there's more people around. And she was going, trust me, it's not that. They just, the difference is directors of films are out of their depth when it comes to sex scenes. They're uncomfortable. They don't know how to, go into it with a plan. They don't know how to take care of their actors. They don't know shot after shot after shot. And it makes these actors, these A-list actors who are used to being coddled, nervous. And if believe me, if I could direct one of those sex scenes, it would go very smoothly. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's just two different worlds, you know?
See, the science, this is science. We're doing science. The science of sex scenes and how they are sort of... perception, reality, those types of conversations come into play. So this is all relevant.
It's a deep question.
Does it get weird, you being an atheist activist? And, I mean, Hollywood isn't like freaking Mobile, Alabama, right? I mean, you guys are a potpourri of every religion and every brand or ilk of spirituality. I mean, there's just a haze. There's crystals and hemp smoke all over the freaking city. You know? So, I mean, does it get weird with anybody when they find out? Or do they know?
I think most of the people that I work with know. I mean, fans are different. I mean, fans get disillusioned very quickly if they find out that I'm not quiet about it, you know. So I get a lot of really disappointed fan mail from people saying, I can't believe I've never watched this.
You don't worry about your job. Like, you know what, if they start to turn on me, then I'm looking for work, right?
Yeah, well, it did start out that way for years. I mean, especially when I first started the YouTube channel, most of my YouTube audience had no idea that I was an actor, and most of my TV audience had no idea that I had this YouTube channel. And I remember there was a point in time where they did start to kind of bleed into each other. It's just, interviewers started asking me about the other thing, and I started just being honest about having these two kind of lives that are parallel to one another. And I got nervous. I thought, oh man, what if my boss finds out, or if the network finds out, am I going to get a slap on the wrist, or worse, is my job in danger if enough people are upset about it? And to my delight, I've been nothing but supported when it comes to the people I work with. And Hollywood, that's the old joke, right? Godless liberal Hollywood. So it's not shocking that they would have my back, but what did surprise me was that they were not hypersensitive to offending our audience just by me having the views that I had. So my boss is really cool about it. The network's been really cool about it. Sometimes I even check in with them and I say, hey, I'm going to be talking about this and it's controversial and this and that. Do you guys have my back? And they say, yes, we have your back. There are people that I work with that are even deeply religious, and it's all good. Like, everybody's cool and they respect me and I respect them. I'm not a contrarian at work. I mean, the secret to, longevity when it comes to especially doing what I do is being a nice guy and amicable, and I'll have disagreements with people, but I'm never, trying to win a debate with somebody at work. So it's really never been an issue.
I think that's there's a lesson there for most of us in the rest of our lives. I mean, you don't have to be a television star, a television actor to realize that in order to attract people, it helps to be attractive. In order to, engage people, it helps to be someone who would, be pleasant to engage. And so, hey, fuck you and fuck the religious doesn't really get us far in the arena of ideas when we're trying to change minds and elevate the discourse out there. But you have engaged. I saw a whole section on your YouTube page, Matt Slick, William Lane Craig. Now, this is years ago, but I got to hear the story. I mean, are they actually engaging you? You guys debating? What's going on?
I've sort of collided with them in two different contexts. With Matt Slick, I've had several chances to have live conversations with him. So I've kind of debated for like 3 hours with him on a Google Hangout about morality, which is kind of very similar to the way that he argues for TAG. I guess transcendental arguments can include moral arguments, but the presuppositionalist stuff is very similar to the way that he argues the moral stuff. With Craig, I did not expect any attention from Craig, and that just sort of happened like a monsoon, and I didn't know how to really deal with it. I had made this very layman video about the Kalam argument and my, Kalam cosmological argument, premise one, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist. Conclusion, therefore, the universe has a cause and that cause is God, that argument. And I made this, I kind of made a video about how, what do you mean by coming into exist? What begins to exist? Nothing begins to exist in the way that you're saying the universe would have begun to exist, because everything else that comes into existence comes from previously existing stuff. And I was just sort of, I wasn't using any technical terminology. Somebody ended up sending this video, I guess, to Craig, and he wrote a blog post and did a podcast episode about it and just lambasted me. For saying that I'm a typical YouTube atheist that doesn't know what I'm talking about. I have no formal education and this and that. And clearly I don't understand the argument. And so I made a follow-up video saying, listen, I was trying to be accessible, but I'll use your terminology. I'll use ex materia versus ex nihilo. And I'm happy to speak that language. I sort of had to learn along the way. And then I reformulated the entire argument and said, okay, here, now critique me, tell me. And once again, I didn't even phrase that video in the second person, like to Craig. I just sort of said, I didn't expect him to ever respond again. He responded again. And it was, really, really intellectually dishonest. He was knowingly misrepresenting me to his audience, and refused to provide a link or anything to my video, except he would quote me out of context and make claims about my argument that are not true. And then I was pissed. And then I kind of got a fire up under my ass, and I made a third video where I really attacked the Kalam argument. And he's done several snipes at me in like podcasts and stuff since then. But, the guy that he does his radio show with, Kevin Harris, I'm friends with on social media, and Kevin's always saying, well, maybe I can get you and Bill together to have a sit down. I'm like, yeah, okay, Kevin. Like, he doesn't do that with anyone. He's not going to do that with me. Like, he won't even debate somebody without a PhD. So come on, what are you talking? But yeah, so the Craig thing was very different from the Matt Slick thing.
Have you ever visited his website? You ever seen Craig's stuff online?
Oh yeah, I have several books of his right here. I mean, I've done my homework on Craig. I've visited his website. If I was gonna critique his sort of like star quarterback argument, I was gonna do my homework, and I did. I disagree with a lot of people on my side. I don't think that special pleading to say that everything that begins to exist has a cause, everything that exists has a cause except for God. I don't think that's the main, that's the fallacy going on there. I think there's a bunch of other stuff going on that's sneaky, and you kind of have to pop the hood and look underneath and see what kind of assumptions he's making in order to get to where. But that argument is deceptively simple. It's part of the advertisement is, look, it's just two premises and a conclusion. It's really straightforward. It's totally intuitive. Nobody would deny this. But once you start looking at it with some criticism, I maintain that it falls apart, and that he uses sort of metaphysical standards that end up shooting him in the foot that he would never accept had they come from somebody else for some other conclusion. It's
so is his take on Kalam just essentially a riff on the precept thing, or is it something else? I mean, I'm not asking to unpack it all here in short form on YouTube.
Yeah, it'd take a minute. No, it's not. It's presuppositionalism is different. I mean, Craig is an evidentialist. I mean, he doesn't believe what the presuppositionalists like Matt Slick believe, which is that, God is the only justification for all intelligibility and logic and reasoning and knowledge. Craig has toyed with that argument. He's, like you say, he's dipped his toe in the waters of presuppositionalism, and I don't think it worked out very well. And I think he felt kind of icky wading around in those waters. So he promptly jumped back out of that pool. But yeah, Craig believes that I don't know where Craig stands on the big presuppositionalist claim, which is that we all know God exists and we're just lying about it. But Craig does believe in in evidence, and he believes that it is his duty as a Christian to give reasons for the existence of God. And hey, I respect that. I respect that a whole lot more than the precept attitude.
Are you one of those guys who is always in debate mode? I mean, not at work or whatnot, but I mean, you know, does your wife ever come in and go, not everything is a debate?
Well, it's hard for me to have an argument, even if the subject of the argument is personal stuff. You know, you didn't do the dishes, or how come you never listen to my feelings, and home stuff, real life stuff. It's still hard for me not to notice the kinds of, I don't want to say fallacies, but the kinds of glitches that we tend to notice in debates. I mean, but because I'm hypersensitive to that, I'm also hypersensitive to my own confirmation bias in my relationships. And so I have to work on that. You know, you always do this. Does she always do this? No, you're just counting the hits and ignoring the misses.
Or does everything have to have a label, Scott? Do you hear that ever? You know, I've heard that one a few times.
So I do. I mean, I can't not think in terms of premises and conclusions, especially when I'm having an argument. I mean, I do tend to think that way.
Well, where did this start? I mean, where does a guy like you, who's an actor, get to the point where they're just so into it? I mean, you're just an autodidact. You're in there just sort of assimilating because, I mean, where did it start, I guess, is the short version of a long question.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you. I'm not reacting to some sort of religious upbringing. I was not raised religious and, you know, fell away from the faith or anything like that. I grew up in a very secular, a philosophical household, but a very secular household. My parents were much more interested in Eastern religions. And so we had books, you know, from Alan Watts and Eastern philosophy and Zen Buddhism and stuff like that in the house. But, so I had a kind of a mind for philosophy, but it wasn't until I was around 9 years old, there was a major earthquake that happened where I lived in LA, in Sherman Oaks, and our house was kind of totaled, and we relocated to a place. You know, California is predominantly liberal, but there are certainly pockets of religiosity and, you know, Christian evangelism. And so we moved to a place in California where suddenly all my new friends and my teachers and the parents of my friends, everybody was an evangelical Christian. And I found myself, you know, as the target of apologetics and evangelism. I mean, I got, you know, I was given the Bible and I was given Lee Strobel books and I was, you know, Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. And I, you know, I went to church with them and I did the youth group stuff because it was the only way I could have a social life was to allow myself to be proselytized to. And before that, I didn't take religion very seriously. I thought as a child, I took religion to be the kind of, to be similar to like Santa Claus. You know, you grow out of it, and then, you know, and you know, yes, parents tell their kids they're going to go to hell if they're bad, but nobody really believes that when they get older. And it wasn't until I moved to this community where I realized, oh my God, people take this shit seriously. And so all that pressure, I think, is what made me realize, okay, I can't just say I don't buy that. I'm going to have to start giving reasons. And so then I started reading parts of the Bible and I started reading their apologetic books. And then I came across, which I didn't even know existed, I started to come across counter apologetics books or sort of counter, you know, Dan Barker, Losing Faith in Faith, and George Smith, Atheism. What was the name of that book? Atheism, The Case Against God, stuff like that. And then my mind was blown and I got really sort of invested, and I started to want to have these conversations because I started to get good at it. And then this is during the time of like AOL, America Online, and they had those chat rooms, and I would go into chat rooms that were religious chat rooms, and I would, because I wanted to practice, I wanted to be able to test, you know, out what I was thinking about. And so I would go into one of those chat rooms and I would say, I'm an unbeliever, convert me, you know, for free. And people would bite. But a lot of those conversations throughout my teenage years, I mean, I would take on Goliaths and get my ass handed to me, and walk away with my tail between my legs and have to figure out either I was wrong or I was making the wrong argument or I wasn't catching the fallacies in their argument. And so I'd have to like regroup and figure out and then have the conversation again and get my ass kicked again. And so it was a process of over a decade. Well, this still happens to me. I still, you know, get my ass handed to me and have to figure out what I missed.
Trust me, it happens to all of us, Scott.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody and they were given, I think their words to me were, I'm talking to a religious person, relative friend, whatever, and they were saying, I need to know how to refute this, which I think is the wrong way to approach it. Like immediately they're thinking, I need to go out and prove them wrong and win.
Yeah, how do you know you're not wrong?
How do you know you're not wrong? And of course, right. I'm a big fan of the Socratic method. I'm not one of those people that thinks it's the only tool in the toolbox, but it's, right. You know, if we can go out and begin to ask questions and kick the tires and tap the glass and find out why we believe what we believe and how we got there, it's sort of a great purification process for the stuff that we buy. Do you do anything with SE? Have you followed that at all?
With this Socratic
street epistemology and using the Socratic method and all that?
You know, street epistemology, it was just came on my radar like a month ago or something. For whatever reason, I've gone all this time without maybe hearing that term, but without ever really connecting with it and looking into it. And then I finally did. And I went, oh, this is, yeah, I do that too, I guess. I think
that places the burden of proof upon the other person. Instead of looking at them and saying, you're wrong, you go, well, why do you believe that? And how do you get there? And what were the processes? And would you use that same process in regard to Islam or Scientology or the Book of Mormon? I mean, essentially, you're not saying you're an idiot. You're saying, hey, well, just tell me how you got there. And many times you just watch them go, you can see their eyes start to spin. Like, you know, it's like the slot at Vegas. They believe it, but they had no idea why they believed it, right?
Yeah. Well, I will say, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that's probably the best way to have a conversation casually. I will say that can be abused like anything else. The Psi 10 camp of presuppositionalism, which we were talking about earlier, that is a kind of,
how do you know you're not a brain in a vat, right?
Exactly.
How do you know this is reality?
And then it starts to get, where it starts to get abused is when they stop asking questions, genuinely and start saying, how do you know that anything that you're saying? And then your epistemology is put on the witness stand before you are even allowed to point out a fallacy in their argument. And that's when street epistemology turns into, no, I'm asking the questions, not you. Then it gets, then it's not fair anymore. It's not good faith arguing anymore. So I think there's a balance there.
Sorry, Tim Brueggenkate actually said that we were asking him to explain his faith based on the scriptures and the Bible. And he said, I don't do Bible studies with atheists, which makes no sense to me. If you're going to go out there and spread the good news and you're going to be an apologist for Jesus Christ in regard to his word, how can you not teach his word? And if you're only teaching it to believers, then you've just written the atheist off entirely. To me, it just makes no sense.
Yeah, he's just misusing the word apologetics. That's the whole point of apologetics, is to defend against criticism, and he won't do that. So that, well, how can you call yourself an apologist?
Here with the actor and activist Scott Clifton. I was going to say beautiful person and actor and activist Scott Clifton. I'm very hesitant to do a video interview with anybody from Los Angeles. I was just there recently. It's me, it's Matt Dillahunty, and then Kara Santa Maria. Of course, she sets up camp there in L.A., and she's on Skeptic's Guide and the Talk Nerdy podcast, and she's on Netflix with Bill Nye and whatnot. And I'm like, we were on stage. You were there. You brought your wife. You were there for just a portion of the event that we did in LA. And I remember looking around thinking, I'm not pretty enough to be in this tent. Like, I need to leave as soon as soft focus. So I hear after the fact, I was going to go up and actually have a conversation for the first time. It's like, I get a chance to really hang and talk with Scott. And you were gone from the LA event.
Yeah.
And they say, well, a skunk is in his house. And I'm just like, that's just total bullshit. There's no way that that's the reason he left.
It was. And in fact, I was even about to, you guys had finished your conversation at that event and the Q&A had started, and you were about like five questions into the Q&A, and I was going to get up and I was going to ask you guys a question. And then my wife and I got a text from our babysitter saying, Yeah, there's a skunk that somehow got into the house, a baby skunk, and all three of your cats are trying to kill it, and I'm having a meltdown, and I don't know what to do, and you need to come home fucking now. And so we had to go. And I actually put a picture of it on Instagram of this, just the cutest little baby skunk. And so I wanted to keep it, but my wife said no, because she's so
survived. Yeah. I would have thought it would have been, you know, mealtime at the Cliftons.
But it was curled up under our coffee table in the living room, and I put my like hand up to it, and it crawled up and like smelled my hand. It was like totally nice and like wanted. It was interested in us. It was very weird. But we found a just so your audience knows, we found a wildlife rehab clinic for it, and it's okay. It's going to be okay.
In my part of the country, it's like food.
Yeah,
and, it just gets really really bad. So I mean. You'll have to forgive me. I'm a corn-fed, you know, Oklahoma boy, born and raised, right? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, you have a caricature in your mind of what my part of the country is, right? And it probably involves tornadoes and gun racks and
yeah, it's almost certainly a caricature, but I've never been to like the real American, you know.
Well, do you have a mental image of the caricature?
You've
been here because it's pretty much accurate.
Really? Okay.
I'm just saying it's not far off. I mean, literally when you drive over the state line, you can hear the banjo. You can hear that. But when I think about Los Angeles, you know, I think about just some wacky stuff. You know, I always think about that scene. I don't know how many movies you've seen in your busy life, but it's, Bowfinger with Steve Martin when they have the Scientology riff. Of that cult called Mindhead, and they're all wearing like the little hats, and they're like Mindhead, and it's you know, just these wild, wacky, new agey kinds of things. Is LA just loaded with that, or is that something they tell the tourists?
No, that's fairly true, and that's part of the reason I've said this before. It's more frustrating to argue with someone who's into new age stuff than it is to argue with an evangelical fundamentalist Christian, because at least with the Christian, you're having the conversation on the same hill. I mean, there are kind of stipulations to that conversation. Objective reality exists. Fallacies are bad. Evidence is good. You know, whereas when it comes to the new age stuff and astrology and numerology and the crystals and the healing I dated a girl for a really long time who was really, really, I mean, she seemed to think that the more stuff she could just believe, the more spiritual it made her. And so you talk about Santa Claus, and she'd go, I believe in Santa Claus. Santa Claus is actually an interdimensional fairy that blah, blah, blah. And you're like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. But you're not wrong that there is a huge culture of that here, and it does seem to be allergic to reason and criticism and stuff like that. It's very hard to.
Well, is it just a variation on I'm not religious, but I am spiritual? I mean, many people who don't want to stick to the fundamentals of any faith, but they love the idea of a higher power or a spiritual membrane. And plus, you know, you can't really, it's like nailing jello to a wall. You have no idea what they mean. That nothing has a definition. It's all nebulous or relative or unique to you.
Falsifiable. I mean,
is that what you run into out there?
But I've, as you know, the older and wiser I get, I've learned not to engage someone or to try to prove. Those are the kind of people that don't want to have an argument with you anyway. So what am I going to, I'm just going to bully them. You know, I've learned to like back off from that.
To be fair though, they're also not the ones who are on the Hill trying to, you know, get the Ten Commandments statues at the courthouse. I mean, if you want to believe that blue crystals cure your cancer, you do so sort of at your peril. Right. You know, we want science to win there, but you know, at least you're not dragging young children into an indoctrination house, right?
Yeah, the consequences of those beliefs are very small and just irritating, not life. You know, if somebody judges you on the basis of your astrological sign at a party, that's annoying, but they're not taking away your right to marriage. So, you know.
What is your astrological sign? Do you know it?
I'm a Scorpio apparently, but what's funny about that, which is so infuriating to me, is that Scorpios are supposed to be argumentative. So
shit. You're so a self-fulfilling prophecy, man.
I know. It's like, God damn, couldn't I have been like a Taurus or something? I don't know.
Somebody asked me, what are you? And I'm like, well, I'm an Aries. And they're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. And I had no idea what they were talking
after
about.
The fact. Yeah. Now, if somebody asks me what my sign is, I say, because they, you know, people only ask you what your sign is once they've gotten a sense of you in conversation and they think they have you pinned. And so somebody asked me what my sign is, and I say, well, why don't you guess? And it's like they get to Scorpio like seventh on the list. And then when I say Scorpio, they go, I knew it. It's like, well, if you knew it, then
I wrote in my book, Sacred Cows, about the Forer effect, where they created, there was, I think in a university setting, they created some sort of meta horoscope and they gave it to everyone and told them that it was, they told them it was unique, right? And they're all like, this is totally me, and not realizing that everybody in the class got the exact same thing. And it showed how they just sort of, they just played right into the whole thing.
But wasn't that study, it wasn't just that they all, I don't know if it was a study or maybe you can call it an experiment, but it wasn't just that they all got the same thing. It was that they all got the horoscope of a serial killer.
Oh, I didn't read that particular study, but that's, if that's not true, it ought to be. What a great line.
Yeah. I hope I'm right about that. Now I'm going to go back and
let us worship at the Church of Google on that score. Are you a philosopher? I mean, you know, is that your playground? Do you like getting into, you know,
the meaning
of life and all that stuff?
I'm interested in questions like that. What is the nature of consciousness, and do we have free will, and is the self an illusion, and stuff that isn't necessarily all about counter apologetics or religion. Yeah. I'm really into that stuff. I'm interested in, I would love one time to ask a professional meta ethicist or like a moral philosopher to interview me and tell me what I actually am, like in terms of like my meta ethics. I have fantasies about that all the time, or not just ethics. I mean, in other areas as well. Cause I'm a high school dropout. I'm not formally educated at all. All of my education comes from conversations with people who are smarter than I am, and me just sort of picking it up through osmosis. So a lot of the time I'm out of my depth and I can reason well, but I don't know, you know, I don't, there's certain, philosophers where I don't know exactly what their stance on this or that was, or certain moral theories or
but you speak like a philosopher. I mean, you have sort of the language, you riff like a philosopher. Just don't let me get too deep into your wheelhouse. Is that a product of a troubled youth that, you know, do you have a pretty rough teenage thing or what?
No, the philosophy.
No. I mean, not finishing high school and that.
Oh, the finishing high school. No, that was just, I was a terrible student. I knew that I didn't want to do anything academic with my life. I hate it. I was, as a kid, if I were a teenager, preteen now in this time in 2018, I'm almost certain I would have been diagnosed with Asperger's, perhaps incorrectly, but, I really had no social skills and I didn't know how to communicate with people and didn't know how to have conversations. It was those religious confrontations. It was the people proselytizing to me. That was the most social I got. And that may be part of why I latched onto that. But,
I don't mean to interrupt you, but before we get too far away, is it that, and I've had these conversations in my own circle about you're a sponge. I mean, just by talking to you, you read books, you're engaging the world, you want to know more tomorrow than you know today. This is not someone who's disinterested in education. So is it that, you know, throwing kids under the white hot fluorescent lights and having them go through chapter by chapter in this kind of banal environment?
Yeah.
Do you feel like the way education was formatted, at least in your case, was part of the reason that you did not connect? Do you learn in a different way? Do you think others would as well? I don't know. Your thoughts?
I would like to believe that. I would like to believe that. No, my brain works differently. And I think it's probably more likely that I'm undisciplined and I'm interested in what I'm interested in. And I'm not interested in what I'm not interested in. And there is part of it that the school, you know, the way that the educational system works or worked when I was a kid, at least, is that we were just taught to kind of memorize a bunch of facts. My favorite class that I ever took that I actually did get an A in because I was so interested was an elective called problem solving. problem solving. And it was so great because it had nothing to do with us memorizing stuff. It was all about teaching us how to think, how to solve problems, and how to, and I really, really enjoyed that. So yes, that's part of it. But I was convinced that I was going to have no interest in academia at all. And I don't, disclaimer here, me dropping out of high school was incredibly stupid and reckless. And I was wrong to do that, and I regret it, and I wish I had stuck it out, and I wish I had gone to college, and I wish I had gotten, you know, I could have pursued philosophy in college. I could have, you know, so I just got really, really lucky that I ended up getting work as a young guy, but it could have gone very, very badly for me, I went back and I got my GED and stuff, and that was, you know, I just had to study for that test and pass the test, and that wasn't hard. But I, you know, I missed out on a profound human experience, whether you like it or not. High school is formative for a lot of people, and I kind of said, you know, fuck you, I'm out. So I wish I hadn't done that.
If I was going to send anybody to your channel, I mean, give me the specifics before we wrap it up here. I mean, if people are now being introduced to you who may not have heard of you yesterday, where do they find your work? What do they do?
So a couple of things. You can find a catalog of probably 100 videos of mine or so on YouTube called Theoretical Bullshit. On Twitter, where I it's mostly politics on Twitter, honestly, and I'm just like, you know, it's done. I'm rampaging against Trump all the time. On Twitter, it's at Clifton's Notes. So Clifton's Notes, all one word. And then Instagram is Clifton Cam. Not a lot of philosophy on the old Instagram, but that's where you can find me.
You mentioned Trump. I got to camp out here for just – I can hear there's a small percentage of my audience that's screaming at me. Most everybody else is on my page. We get each other. We're in the foxhole together, waiting for the term to end, wondering, hoping we will survive. But no. There's a few people who, and they'll appear on my social media pages and email inbox to chastise me for being so religious about my politics. And if only I hadn't, you know, decided in advance that he was such an awful person and blah, blah, blah. Trump, I mean, just go. Just what? Scott, what do you think?
There's a couple of things that have gone on in the Trump era. Nothing I say right now, I'm going to be the first to have said. So I'm just parroting, intentionally or not, things that smarter people than I have already said. But there's this compartmentalization of where we get our news, which is really fucking us up. We're all kind of predisposed to seek out our news from sources that are confirmed in advance to that.
They speak to our biases. The algorithms in place and all that.
Sources that are guaranteed in advance to confirm our worldview and not disconfirm it. So that's a problem. We're all living in these tiny little circles. And the reason I'm so political on Twitter actually is because I'm in a very unique position. Most of my audience, because of the TV show, is like American South, American Midwest, Trump supporters. And yet I've got their attention. I mean, most of these people would not ever, they have no interest, no desire at all to listen to somebody's point of view from the other side, but I kind of have a captive audience because they like the show. So I get to engage with a lot of Trump supporters, and it's a different ball game. It's not, there's no fact you can show. It's not about truth. It's about tribalism, and it's about my side versus your side. You can point out a double standard till the world ends, and they don't care that they hold a double standard. What they care about is that they're winning. There's been a cultural change lately, and I spent a lot of time lately thinking about how to have those seemingly impossible conversations. And yes, I've had breakthroughs, but they're very, very fucking rare. This world, I mean, you know, and then of course the president is just an imbecile. I mean, we've never had somebody this. Other people have other, you know, that he's a racist and this and that. Yes, fine. But he's also a moron. I mean, we've never had somebody this unintelligent in office. And you combine unintelligence with bravado and arrogance, and you've got the kind of problems that we're having. Yes, I know that there's responses to that, and I'm sure I'll be hearing from people. But
I saw it on Fox News, Scott, and that's all that there is to it. Blah, blah, blah. Right? Why don't you just give him a chance? Look how successful he is. Didn't you read The Art of the Deal? I mean, I've heard all of these
arguments. 2 years I've been giving the guy a chance.
I think to myself, you know, what's this do to the office itself? We're now right at this weird point. We're in 2020, whatever happens. We've lowered expectation in regard to the most powerful office in the United States, arguably the most powerful office in the United States. We've lowered expectation to the point where is it forever damaged? And again, this is all speculation. But
here's a thought, and that is that it may still, despite all of this, it may still have been better that he won than Clinton. Yes, I believe Clinton is more competent in every way and would have been a better president objectively. But culturally, if this subgroup of if Trump supporters didn't get their way, I think we'd be living in an even worse off world right now, an even more polar. At least now, people like you and I at the end of this are gonna get to say, "I told you so." And without that, if we had been living in the other world where Clinton won, we wouldn't have that counterfactual, and everybody would be saying Trump would have done so much better. I'm trying to see the silver lining here, and I think there probably is one. I think this is a giant pendulum swing, and we may be headed back in the other direction soon. I'm really hoping. A lot of precedents have been broken in terms of ethics and our values and the spirit of the law, but I hope we find our way back.
Scott Clifton, people in your audience will forgive you for disagreeing with him politically because you're going to be naked on TV next week.
That's correct.
I, on the other hand, haven't seen myself naked since the 80s, and I just wouldn't do that to you. I'm just saying. So it's a real joy to talk to you. You're the kind of guy I could just probably, I can see us over a beer and the entire evening is gone and we just scratch the surface. And that's my favorite kind of discussion. And that's really good.
Yeah, me too. Me too, Seth.
All right. Well, I'll make sure and link to your site and pages in the description box of this broadcast. You keep kicking the tires out there, and all success to you in your work and in your activism. And maybe our paths will cross again. Okay.
You too. Will do, brother. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.